Welcome to the WWE Podcast, the most passionate and authentic wrestling analysis on the web. We've got you covered with every Raw, SmackDown, and NXT show, giving you a no bullshit opinion. We know you love wrestling. We do too. So let's get this show underway.
And that's the bottom line. What? Cause Stone Cold said so.
What is going on, guys? Welcome back to another edition of the SmackDown Review here on the WWE Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Michael Ritter, and today we're going to be talking about the SmackDown that aired on November 6th, 2020. Welcome back, though, guys. I'm glad you decided to listen to me on this Saturday afternoon. It means a lot, and I greatly appreciate it. I am getting more and more comfortable every week here as the SmackDown host, and I'm looking forward to getting more and more comfortable. I appreciate everybody who's reached out to make me feel more and more at home here. Shout out to DJ Kuzmo on Twitter. Wanted to go there real quick to say thanks for the interaction on Twitter every week. I appreciate you listening to the show, man. It means a lot. But here on today's episode, got some bonus content for you again. Similar to last week, we got another top five. This week, it is the top five character changes. Going to go over a few of my favorite. Again, it's my top five, not everybody's top five, but my top five character changes of all time. And I also have a little bit of bonus content for you. Speaking of Twitter, DJ actually reminded me last week whenever I did my top five Survivor Series teams of all time that I actually left off a pretty memorable Survivor Series match. Not that either team was necessarily as stacked as any of the others, but as far as the match itself goes, this was actually one of my very favorite matches just in general, not even just Survivor Series. If you're familiar with that Survivor Series 2003 card, you know that it was absolutely stacked and it just did not disappoint. But I'm going to get into the Team Austin versus Team Bischoff with a little bit of audio later on. So we're going to get to the SmackDown review first, like we normally do, and then at the end of the show, I'm going to provide you with a little bit of audio, and then, of course, do the top five character changes of all time. But first things first, we're going to get this SmackDown review kicked off here. And this SmackDown itself was kicked off with the SmackDown Women's Championship match between Bayley and Sasha. Now, they started here with the video package showing the buildup from weeks and weeks. They showed whenever they were partners, whenever they were just basically running through the entire SmackDown and Raw roster, because when they were the Women's Tag Team Champions, they were going back and forth. They even made some appearances on NXT, and no one could really match up to what they were doing. So the women's division was basically theirs for about 3 or 4 months there. And Bayley cuts a promo backstage before the match, kind of just reminding us, as if we don't already know, that Sasha has never successfully defended her championship. So she hopes that she had a good 13 days as champion. And this match begins in somewhat of a stalemate before the two begin trading shots, and end up being kind of an electrifying match, which isn't really something that you get with these two. Normally they're known for their in-ring abilities and kind of how their movesets are among the best in the whole women's division on both shows. But they actually spent a lot of time outside of the ring here. I noticed that Sasha found creative ways to kind of fly through the air and do her normal knees to the neck or the shoulder things, some crossbody type things. She was doing some things on the side of the apron. Just basically going all out here. I mean, Sasha stepped her game up for this. This was a match that featured a lot of kickouts, mainly by Sasha. I think I counted 7, but there were 2 near falls. When Bayley attempts to bring some weapons into the ring to kind of distract the official, Sasha eventually throws the chair out. She tried to bring a kendo stick in as well. But She basically does that just to try to get the upper hand on Sasha. It doesn't work. Like we said, Sasha kicked out 7 times. And she eventually wins clean with a backstabber followed by a bank statement in the middle of the ring, forcing Bayley to tap out. So, obviously, round of applause here. Sasha gets her first successful career title defense. And finally, from the looks of it here, ends this feud with Bayley. So for those of you that wanted this to stretch out even to the Royal Rumble, TLC, it doesn't even look like it's going to go that far, because after this, Sasha is walking up the ramp and she gets attacked, sneak attacked by Carmella. I actually didn't expect this. She gets super kicked by her. I actually didn't even know it was Carmella at first. I thought it might have been Lacey Evans, which, honestly, I'm not even sure if Lacey Evans is on SmackDown or Raw, so that's on me. I should definitely know that, but that's ultimately who I thought it was at first. Turns out it was Carmella, which tells me that that must be where Sasha's going next. So it looks like, because, I mean, you guys know the number one rule to get a title shot in WWE is attack the champion. Carmella did that in her very first appearance back, so she went straight to the source. And we'll see what happens, but I am fully expecting a Sasha and Carmella program going forward. Probably not at Survivor Series. I mean, you can expect that maybe with all of these matches at Survivor Series, that there might be some interference in some with the feuds that they actually have going on. For instance, Drew McIntyre might get involved, or The Fiend, in that Roman Reigns versus Randy Orton matchup. You can see now Carmella maybe getting involved in the Sasha versus Asuka matchup. I mean, there's a lot of different things that can happen. So, as we've said before, this pay-per-view is somewhat of a throwaway, I guess you can say. Which, before I get too far, I'm glad I actually mentioned that. I did want to touch on something real quick that I heard from Matt when I listened to the Raw review earlier this week. He mentioned that it's a shame to say, but Survivor Series has become a throwaway pay-per-view, which I didn't really notice that. I didn't really think about it, but he is exactly right. That is exactly what it's become, and that is a shame, because as you'll hear later on in the show, some very, very important and big things have happened at Survivor Series. It's one of the big four pay-per-views of the year, so I don't understand how creative Vince McMahon, whoever is the one that's allowing this to become what it has become. I'm not on board with that, but that brings me to another point here, which I think that the Money in the Bank is somehow, or just basically if you think about it from what you win at Money in the Bank, is it not kind of taken its place as a pay-per-view in the Big Four, or maybe just made it a Big Five pay-per-view? Because when you think about the Money in the Bank, what you win, it's almost equal to what you win if you win the Royal Rumble, maybe even better. Strictly because, yeah, you might not get the main event in WrestleMania, which you can if you choose to cash it in there, but it's almost more advantageous for you because you get to do it literally whenever you want. So the chances of you winning that championship are almost increased. In fact, they are increased. So basically what I'm saying is I think that Money in the Bank is slowly making its way to being part of that Big Four, Big Five pay-per-view schedule. And when you look at Survivor Series for what it is now, it's hard not to say that Money in the Bank has completely taken its spot. But moving on here before I get too off topic. After the SmackDown Women's Championship match, there's actually a pretty big gap before there's another match. There's about three or four backstage segments along with a couple commercial breaks. So there's actually a pretty long time before we get to another match. So going through some of the backstage stuff that happened here, we get something with Kevin Owens and Jey Uso where Jay's back there kind of drinking coffee or making his coffee, and Kevin walks up and he just makes a joke kind of saying, that Jay is now getting Roman his coffee, which Jay takes very personally, and asks if Kevin thinks that his family's a joke. And Kevin says he was kidding and that he only approached Jay to basically talk about them being teammates at Survivor Series. And he walks off kind of awkwardly. And Jay has a little bit of a dark look in his eyes, similar to kind of what Roman Reigns has been having. But a little bit more happens there here in a little bit after a commercial break, because Jay is seen with Kayla Braxton. And I noticed here, I'm not sure if anybody else did, Kayla was kind of being pretty snarky with her responses. Obviously, she was probably told to do so and doing it on purpose, but it's almost like everybody that talks to Jey Uso kind of either belittles him or just throws some shade at him. But that's kind of what he was accusing Kayla of doing. But the interview starts with Kayla showing a video package of the Hell in a Cell pay-per-view and what happened last week on SmackDown, such as the humiliating opening segment with Jey and Roman Reigns, and also what he did to Daniel Bryan after their match. So Kayla asks him to explain his actions. He responds with he did what he had to do. It was nothing personal. He considers Daniel Bryan a friend. He says he's sorry, but Daniel isn't family, and family is forever. But Paul Heyman interrupts there and asks if Roman Reigns approved of this interview. He says it's a rhetorical question and that Roman would like to see him. So Kayla throws a little bit more shade by saying that even Paul Heyman has a better spot in the family than he does. So, yeah, we'll get to a little bit more of that here in just a second, because after this, there is a shot of Rey Mysterio backstage shown frantically talking on the phone, or at least trying to talk on the phone, trying to get a hold of Aaliyah, and he can't do it. Dominic walks up somewhat in a panic state himself, because Rey has a match next, and he's not even in his gear. So Rey asks Dominic to go grab his gear for him, and as soon as Dominic leaves the picture, Baron Corbin comes out of nowhere and just cheap shots Rey Mysterio, basically just trying to get an advantage of their match that comes up here pretty soon. So that basically just kind of sets the tone for what's to come with the Rey Mysterio stuff here coming up. But back to the Jey Uso and Paul Heyman stuff, they finally show that Roman or Jey Uso and Paul Heyman are having a discussion outside of Roman Reigns' private locker room. And Paul's just basically reiterating that Jey needs to ask permission from Roman before he does an interview like that, which didn't really make sense to me as to why they were doing that. But Jey even shows signs of frustration that he doesn't like that he has to ask permission to do an interview. But they basically shut him down. Roman eventually comes out of his private locker room and confronts Jey about it. He tells him that if Jey wants to do something like that, he needs to ask him. And if he can't find him, he needs to ask Paul Heyman, which I thought was kind of funny, just from the perspective of, like, it kind of reminds me of, like, if you, like, say your dad tells you you need to ask his permission to do something, and if he's not around, you need to go ask your stepmom or something. I don't know, I just thought that was kind of funny that Jey Uso is having to ask Paul Heyman, and he even has to answer to him. But anyway, Roman then asks about the Kevin Owens situation that happened earlier, and kind of begins to instigate a little bit by saying that he can't believe that Jey let him disrespect him like that. And he says that when he disrespects Jey, he's disrespecting their entire family. And he just asks Jey what he's going to do about it, and Jey says he's going to handle it, and he kind of walks off. But after he walks off, they pan the camera over to Roman Reigns and Paul Heyman. And you can just kind of see Roman has like an angry look on his face. And he asks Paul if he knew about this, referring to the whole Kevin Owens situation. But he asks it in almost a betrayed way, that he feels like maybe he was betrayed. I don't know. I mean, that's just kind of the vibe I got. But he then tells Paul to go find Adam Pearce so they can handle this right now. So I'm guessing that's exactly what he does. But after this, moving on, we get a Survivor Series men's team qualifying match, which is only the second match of the night. And this happened about near the 1 hour mark of SmackDown, probably between 45 minutes to 1 hour. So like I said, there was a lot of backstage stuff that happened there. But here in this qualifying match, it was pretty much dominated by Corbin. Rey did show signs of life, But, I mean, this is basically an onslaught from start to finish. Seth Rollins comes out, begins cheering on Corbin and antagonizing Dominic from the top of the ramp. And Corbin eventually makes his way to the outside of the ring and cheap shots Dominic, knocks him basically just on his ass, and he's kind of just laying there. And eventually Seth Rollins kind of creeps up slowly to the ramp, or slowly to the ring. They show that, and he starts attacking Dominic. As after that happens, basically all hell breaks loose. Ray comes out of the ring, and eventually Aaliyah and Murphy come out, seemingly to help the Mysterios, which didn't really make sense to me, but Ray still wants no part of Murphy even after that. But the entire distraction caused Ray to take his eye off Corbin just long enough for him to hit the End of Days, get the win, and qualify for the Men's Survivor Series team. But about Murphy coming out to help the Mysterios, I really don't understand why, considering what happened last week with Ray, Dominic, and Seth. I mean, all three of them had their own physical altercations with Murphy in the ring during all that stuff. So I'm not really sure what he thought he needed to come out there for. It was kind of weird. I mean, I guess we get a little bit of answers for it here later. But for now, they kind of left you just a little bit confused as to what Buddy was doing. But after this, we get another Survivor Series qualifying match. This time it's for the women's team. And this one is another triple threat, similar to the last week. We get Natalya, Ruby Riott, and Zelina Vega. So this is Natalya's second opportunity, actually. She was in the triple threat last week. And this one, I mean, there really wasn't much to the match itself. Natalya and Ruby, they both have Zelina in a submission. And she's kind of fighting. But as soon as Natalya releases her sharpshooter, Zelina taps out, obviously giving the win and the spot in the women's team to Ruby Riott. So Natalya will probably, now that I kind of notice them, what they're doing, she'll probably be back next week, maybe in another qualifying match. We'll see about that. But I was actually pretty surprised that Ruby Riott won. It just kind of seemed like if anybody was going to win, I thought that maybe Zelina Vega had the most upside, given that it's Survivor Series, and this could be a time that could maybe catapult her or boost her singles run, where she, you know, maybe is the lone survivor left on the team and she has, you know, a nice showing. But they end up giving the spot to Ruby, so I'm not really sure what they're doing there. I do know that as of right now, you guys know that I'm a big fan of Bianca Belair, but the Raw women's team is definitely looking a little bit more stout. Other than Lana, I mean, they have a lot of pretty good women over there, so we'll see what happens going forward, but definitely want to keep an eye on how the rest of that team shapes up. But after this match, let's see here, we get a backstage segment with Big E and the Street Profits, and it's really not even a segment. I mean, they really don't even do anything. They're kind of just teasing you with Big E basically saying that he's not going to give them any tips. He kind of just says, lay down in the middle of the ring and they won't beat you up as bad. They start laughing. It was actually kind of awkward. There's really not much to that at all. So we can go ahead and move on to the next match, which was another Survivor Series qualifying match. See, every match here so far has a little bit of meaning to it. So far, I mean, with the Women's Championship match and all the other ones have been qualifying matches. The only other match later in the night is the Kevin Owens and Jey Uso match, which that has a lot, I mean, you at least got a little bit of, you know, of a storyline behind it. You got a small build just from the earlier in the night and the storyline with Roman kind of intertwining there. So every single match here had a little bit of at least stipulation to what the winner gets or a good storyline behind it. So I can get behind all these matches. But this qualifying match was between Otis and Seth Rollins. I think everybody knew who should have and was going to win this match. But you never know. So we watched anyway. I mean, they show the Mysterio family watching backstage, which again makes absolutely no sense. I mean, when you think about it, Rey Mysterio literally just got beat up by Baron Corbin. They just had some family drama spill outside the ring. I don't understand. Like, now they're just standing there watching Seth's match. Like, if they hate him so much, why are they watching his matches? It just makes absolutely no sense. But I'm not going to go any further on that. As far as the Mysterios go, back to this match. Murphy comes out to the ring. And this is kind of weird. This is where I say it kind of, you at least get a little bit of an idea as to what he might have been doing earlier whenever he interfered in Rey Mysterio's match. But he comes down, he kind of just stares there. His hands are together like they were, and he's kind of just staring. He's staring at Seth. He stares at Otis. He actually interferes or distracts both of these guys at some point during the match. But his distraction to Otis ultimately cost him the match, and Seth Rollins hits the stomp and gets the win. But this match, actually, just before we touch a little bit on the Buddy Murphy stuff, the match itself, I feel like with the winner, Seth Rollins, it adds some much-needed legitimacy to the SmackDown Survivor Series men's team. I was worried that Murphy might, when he came out, I was worried that Murphy might have costed Seth the match, so I'm glad that didn't happen. SmackDown definitely needs Seth on the team if they're going to have any chance of beating Raw. So I'm glad that he is there for sure. But back to the Murphy stuff. Seth eventually catches up to him backstage and says that he thought he saw something tonight, kind of just referring to Murphy's actions, helping him ultimately by distracting Otis get the win. And Murphy, this is where it kind of gets confusing. He does his old, disciple Messiah, where he's pointing at him and then he points at Seth. And Seth, that kind of just, he says himself that that brings music to his ears. And he's really happy. He walks away with excitement. He's basically under the impression that he has his disciple Murphy back at his side. But before anything else happens, Aaliyah walks up screaming and shoving Murphy, kind of asking him how he could help Seth after everything that's happened with her family. He grabs her and begs her to calm down. He tells her that he knows what he's doing and that he needs her to trust him, and that he's doing this for the quote-unquote greater good. So obviously, what I took away from this is he is probably trying to plot something to betray Seth to maybe earn the Mysterio's trust back. Or, I mean, he never really had it, but he's trying to earn the Mysterio's trust. I'm not sure how far that's going to get him, but you can kind of see what he's going to do. I don't know if they're going to go all out with him, you know, changing his gear back to the matching gear that he had that said Disciple written on it. If he's going to fully try to fool Seth Rollins into thinking that he is actually back on his side again. I mean, we'll see. This could all be a trick here. I mean, I have no idea what to expect from Murphy, but I guess we will definitely find out soon. But after this, we get a Michael Cole interview with Lars Sullivan. And Cole kind of asks him about the interview last week with Corey Graves. And Lars starts by talking about how much he hates bullies and how he was bullied for the way he looks, the way he talks, and the way he dressed. He talks about being 15 years old, gaining 50 pounds of pure muscle, and then the bullying stopped because he became the bully. He began getting joy from making people do whatever he wants, making them eat dirt, bugs, and glass. He even lets out a random scream for basically no reason, which was pretty weird. I mean, I know I wasn't supposed to, but that, I mean, I almost found that part right there funny. I mean, I was legitimately trying to take it serious, but I mean, sometimes I can't help it. Like, he just legitimately screamed out of nowhere. But anyway, I mean, I don't know. For someone who doesn't like to be called a freak, he sure does like to do some freaky interviews. But anyway, this was just some more graphic depth into Lars' childhood. These interviews kind of portray him as someone who's literally about to explode and just like destroy anybody in sight. But I do like what they're doing in terms of bringing him back slowly and not overexposing him in the ring, to put the focus more on establishing his character and getting the fans familiar with who he is. Because, I mean, I was trying to think about it, and I really don't think that Lars has had a meaningful feud since he's been on the main roster. I mean, I guess if you count the Lucha House Party stuff, which I do not. So I don't think that off the top of my head he's had anything really meaningful on the main roster. So I'm hoping that maybe with this build up to his new character. I'm not sure who's going to challenge him. That is just, I mean, obviously there's really no one that can match up with him. I would like to see maybe Big E go one-on-one with him, but we'll see about that. But just as far as Lars goes, just another interview. We'll see if maybe next week we can get him in the ring in some one-on-one action. But up next, we have the main event, which is Jey Uso versus Kevin Owens, a match between two members of the Survivor Series team for SmackDown. And if you remember last week, I talked about Kevin Owens and his possible new gear. Well, you can throw that out the window. He was back in his shorts again, so whatever. That was my fault for assuming that he might be changing. So yeah, he's back to his normal stuff. But this match, I mean, it was pretty aggressive. Obviously, when you look at Jey Uso's new edge that he has and how he's just super, I don't know, he's really different as far as what we've all been used to. We've never really seen this side of him from a singles competitor standpoint. And Kevin Owens, just who he is. I mean, those two with where they are right now, that's just asking for a physical match. So after about 10 to 12 minutes, though, Roman Reigns' music hits and distracts Kevin Owens and the official for just a second, but that was long enough for Jey to headbutt Kevin Owens in the groin, which I've noticed they've been doing a lot lately, just the headbutt to the groin to kind of get the upper hand. I'm not sure why. I mean, I'd rather use my hand or something, but whatever, that's all them. But after he headbutts him in the groin area, it's followed by another super kick. This match is full of super kicks. Like, oh my gosh. They even acknowledge it on the announce team. But if you watch it, seriously, it is crazy. But after Jey Uso's final super kick, he does a splash to pick up the win. But this is obvious tension going forward for the SmackDown team. I mean, I'm not sure. Kevin Owens might be the only babyface, if you even want to call him one, that's on the SmackDown team. So he's a little bit outnumbered there. Roman Reigns, he's kind of building a list of enemies quick with Kevin Owens. I mean, Daniel Bryan, what happened last week? He wasn't on the show. I'm guessing they're kind of playing off the attack. I'm not sure exactly who Roman Reigns is going to put his focus on. Because right now it just seems like he has his guys that he's focusing on, but he's using Jey Uso kind of as a tool. So it's almost like he's targeting people and he's using Jey Uso to do his dirty work, which is what a heel faction leader does. So hopefully this is leading to Roman Reigns getting more people alongside. Everybody's speculating about Jimmy Uso maybe starting that heel faction. So I just noticed that. I wonder exactly where Daniel Bryan is going to go, because they said that I heard basically on, I'm not sure, it was probably on either a voicemail or one of Matt's earlier shows about Daniel Bryan, this being his last singles run. So I don't know if they're going to actually try to, you know, play off that he's legitimately injured. I mean, I feel like he was just getting back. So I'd like to see him definitely in the ring and not on the sidelines. But I guess you can take what you get. But they have Roman Reigns and Jey Uso standing victorious again to close out SmackDown. And that is the end of the SmackDown review. Another good show. I really, like I said, every match was pretty meaningful. There was a lot of backstage stuff, but overall, I did like this show. So the Survivor Series teams got a little more clear as to who's going to be on there. You could expect that to probably get finished up next week. Alright, and like I promised, we're going to get to the top 5 character changes now. And with this one, I actually threw in a honorable mention because they themselves are not a wrestler. But I feel like this change was very monumental in the wrestling world, and even kind of how it is, and even shaped up how it is today. So the honorable mention here is Vince McMahon himself, who was a wholesome commentator to an evil boss. And just like I did last week, I'm kind of going to give my top 5 and then read some quotes here from an article, this one by Eric Rhodes. So let's see, Vince McMahon. This one says, it's hard to pinpoint exactly when the Attitude Era began. Most believe that WrestleMania 14 is where the era fully began, but there were glimpses of new attitude taking form during 1997. Fans got a taste of what a villainous boss could be like when McMahon, the person, feeling he had no other choice, enacted the Montreal Screwjob. In the ensuing weeks, Vince McMahon would deliver the Bret Screwed Bret promo and declare, oh hell no, when asked if he wanted to see Stone Cold Steve Austin as champion. For almost 20 years until that point, fans had only seen Vince as a happy-go-lucky commentator, trading barbs with Jesse Ventura and later Jerry Lawler, but after Montreal, the genie was out of the bottle. If you didn't know Vince owned the WWE, you did now. Rather than fight back the jeers and righteous crowds chanting, you screwed Bret, McMahon embraced his heel side and became the biggest heel of the Attitude Era. At number 5 here, I actually have JBL. And I've mentioned JBL before when talking about character changes, but I've never really gotten to go into detail a little bit. And the reason why I feel so strongly about this one, I was never really even a JBL fan. Like, I want to say that whenever he was in his prime as JBL, the WWE champion, I was never a fan of his. But I do feel like this character change should be shown to wrestlers on the current roster and NXT, wherever, because it is literally textbook for what you can do if you're a mid-card tag team wrestler or just in a position where, I mean, you're kind of walking in place, you're not going anywhere, and you don't like where you are. You can change it. You just have to be willing to make a complete 180 or just completely change everything about yourself. I mean, when you look at JBL, he had long black hair, facial hair, just... he was drinking beer, playing poker backstage a lot of the times. And then out of nowhere, he had a haircut. His hair was blonde, no facial hair. He was wearing suits and a cowboy hat. I mean, I remember being, I think I was in like the fourth or fifth grade, literally, whenever this happened. And I just remember thinking like, holy crap, who is it? Like, I remember him in the APA, but I had no idea that it was him whenever he came out as JBL until I actually realized that the B stood for Bradshaw. But I think he is definitely, for how he executed this character change, he is more than worthy to be on the top 5. So I'm giving him that 5 spot. And what's written about him here, it says, he started as many big, tough Texans start out. A cowboy complete with a Stetson hat, chaps, and a bull rope. Then he teamed up with Barry Windham as the new Blackjacks. However, It was as one member of the APA where Bradshaw, along with Farouk, became known for his strong style. The APA is where Bradshaw would enjoy his greatest success, or so we thought. Whether it was for his years of servitude or because Vince McMahon felt he was good enough to carry the gold, Bradshaw was given a world title run. But he had to change his character first. In a complete 180 turn, gone was the ornery Texan who loved to fight. In his place was a George Bush-loving, New York-living stockbroker who gloated about his money and rode to the ring in a limousine decorated with Texas Longhorns. And up next at number 4, I have Mick Foley, who is basically the person who's most known for character changes. I mean, he basically wrote the book on it. And for him, it says, Mick Foley was already a world-renowned and respected hardcore brawler when he debuted on Raw after WrestleMania 12, especially as Cactus Jack. However, Vince McMahon loves taking established stars, slapping them with new gimmicks, and seeing if they'll get over. Thus, Mankind was born. Mankind was able to get himself over as a fierce fighter to be feared, but it was the shoot-style interview with Jim Ross that started to humanize the character. The fans started to cheer for the mutilated freak, and we learned about how Mick Foley really wanted to be a guy named Dude Love. In one of the most memorable moments in Foley's career, all three of his characters would appear together on the Titantron at Madison Square Garden. Before a Falls Count Anywhere match that Dude was set to have with rival Hunter Hearst Helmsley, a special edition of the Love Shack aired where Dude Love bowed out of the match and thought that Mankind would be able to handle things. But Mankind said there's someone else who wants to hurt Helmsley even more than he did, Cactus Jack, to which the Dude proclaimed, somebody spank me, I thought he was dead. Mrs. Foley's baby boy has returned home to the character he made famous and debuted at the world's most famous arena. And at number three here, I have one of my personal favorite wrestlers of all time. Like I alluded to, I grew up, at least in my early years, as a WCW guy. So at number three here, I have Sting. And he was actually the first wrestler that I got to touch in person. And I think it was 1999 at a WCW event. I remember that like it was yesterday. The main event was Booker T versus Diamond Dallas Page for the World Heavyweight Championship. It was actually pretty crazy, but that is a story for another day. Hear about Sting. He was the face of WCW. He was its franchise. He was the locker room leader who sat back and allowed Eric Bischoff to sign the likes of Hulk Hogan and Macho Man. Sting allowed all of it to happen, but he would not allow WCW or the fans to doubt the Stinger. During the build to Fall Brawl 1996, the NWO had convinced us all that Sting had joined their ranks. It sure seemed that way when, quote-unquote, Sting attacked his best friend Lex Luger. At the event, Sting tried to convince Luger it wasn't him, but the total package didn't believe his best friend. The fourth member of both the NWO and WCW teams was Sting, and it was now apparent that the NWO Sting was an imposter. The real Sting demolished the NWO, flipped off Luger, and left the ring for the NWO to win the match. The next night on Nitro, Sting, with his back to the camera, told all of us to stick it. He would show up again a few months later with ghost face paint and a black trench coat, which for the next year would become the man called Sting's new look, reminiscent of James O'Barr's The Crow, the Avenger of WCW, and eventual vigilante of the WWE. At number two here, I have probably one of the more popular and more familiar character changes, and that is none other than The Undertaker, going from the Dead Man to the American Badass. This was a character change that was more than just a little tweak here and there. I mean, he changed a lot about himself, from his entrance, his look, to his music, just the type of character he was. I mean, I don't even have to tell you. Everybody already knows exactly how good The Undertaker is at evolving. And this just might have been whenever it was magnified, or at least the most popular moment. But anyway, since his debut at the 1990 Survivor Series, The Undertaker was The Walking Dead before it was a cool TV show. He'd feel no pain and he barely would be defeated. During the Attitude years, the Phenom got progressively more evil. He reunited with Paul Bearer, formed the Ministry of Darkness, crucified Stone Cold Steve Austin, and tried to marry Stephanie McMahon. He aligned with Vince McMahon and the corporate ministry was born. Once the ministry disbanded, an unholy alliance with the Big Show was born. Here, the Dead Man would start to wear more biker clothing, but the true American Badass was born after The Undertaker quit, quote-unquote, in September of 1999. In reality, he went to rehab a torn pectoral muscle. He returned to Judgment Day 2000. Taker would revert back to the bit that made him famous 4 years later, but Biker Undertaker still remains the closest thing we've gotten to The Undertaker knowing the actual man behind the character. That is before the Untold, or the Undertaker Last Ride documentary series. That told us a lot more. I'm guessing that this article where he has his quotes was before that, because that's obviously where we learned a lot about The Undertaker. But he's right, before that, this character was really the closest that we got to that. So I know a lot of people are big fans of this Undertaker. I've actually gone back and watched some of it, just regular SmackDown episodes whenever he was the American Badass. And he's actually a very different Undertaker. You notice he cheats a lot to win. He does the heel tactics where he always just tries to, you know, sneak his way out of a win, which is actually kind of weird to see, especially if you're only familiar with The Undertaker now, with how he's basically just unanimously and universally respected by everybody. Just so to see him using like cheating tactics is kind of weird to see. But anyway, Number two, I feel like Undertaker definitely deserves that spot. And at number one here, atop the list, probably is no surprise to a lot of you, at least most of the older fans, but it is Hulk Hogan turning into Hollywood Hulk Hogan, the childhood hero to the Hollywood bad guy. Since January 23rd, 1984, Hulkamania has been running wild. Hulk Hogan was one of the reasons so many of us watched wrestling. Hogan fans would eat up everything the blonde behemoth said as he beckoned Hulksters, big and small, to eat their vitamins, train, and say their prayers. There was no wrong Hogan could do in those days. How on earth do you go from being one of the most beloved icons in America to being the most hated man in wrestling? Well, you go to the WCW and side with an invading Kevin Nash and Scott Hall to form the New World Order. Gone was the trademark Hogan yellow and red. In its place was NWO's black and white. He'd deliver the same style promo, but he wouldn't ask Hulkamaniacs to do anything except bow down to him and declare him the god of wrestling. The story is that if Hogan didn't end up turning, it would have been Sting. However, we all know it needed to be Hogan, and it should have been. WCW would have never gained the heights it did without the immortal icon. And I do agree there. I actually consider myself very lucky that I got to witness the tail end of that as my introduction to wrestling in those WCW days. The NWO was really something. It probably had a lot to do with why I became a wrestling fan. Obviously, I still consider the best years of me watching wrestling the Ruthless Aggression era, but it's hard not to appreciate those early days, what really got you hooked. But anyway, guys, that was my top five character changes. I hope you enjoyed it. I want to keep doing these top fives. I think they're pretty cool. If you guys have something that you want me to do a top five of, or if you just want to tell me your top five, if you disagree, whatever, you can message me or at me on Twitter. That's at Michael5Ritter. So, like I said, if you guys have any suggestions for a top five or anything like that, just let me know. But like I promised, we're going to get to some audio from the Survivor Series 2003. But before I do that, I kind of want to give you an idea about what exactly it is. Like I said last week, I did my top five Survivor Series teams of all time. And I was reminded on Twitter about an arguably the best Survivor Series card of all time, which I know that's very subjective. It's probably not true, but in my life, this was the Survivor Series I enjoyed the most. It was in Dallas, Texas at the American Airlines Center. I obviously do not live that far from Dallas, Texas. I actually knew some people who went to this event, so it was pretty cool. And like I said, there was a lot of cool stuff that happened. Shane McMahon and Kane had their ambulance match, which Anthony DeMarco has touched on in a Rivalries episode. Undertaker obviously had his Buried Alive match with Vince McMahon, where the American Badass character was in fact put to rest, literally and figuratively. But what we're going to talk about here tonight is the elimination match between Eric Bischoff, or Team Eric Bischoff versus Team Stone Cold Steve Austin. And I remember this very vividly. This was a pay-per-view that I did not get to watch live. But I remember this time period. I remember watching, I'm pretty sure, at least like a month or so later, I finally got to watch it. But this was a pretty emotional match. I feel like from, if you're a big Stone Cold Steve Austin fan, I feel like this moment right here kind of goes under the radar. It's not really talked about a lot, where you actually see Stone Cold kind of show a little bit of an emotional side, and that's what he does. I'm going to play that audio for you second. But first, also in this match, this is whenever Shawn Michaels really got, quote-unquote, put over for me as a fan, because like I said, obviously, I was a WCW guy, so I didn't get to watch him in the 90s before he came back. So whenever he came back to the WWE in 2002, this was really the moment for me that made me, or that really put Shawn Michaels on the map, that said, holy crap, this guy is legit. He has an absolute just crazy showing. He does all he can to save Stone Cold Steve Austin. because like we have alluded to here, and I know for a fact Matt has said, is that these Survivor Series matches have no consequences. They have no rewards if you win other than bragging rights. So this particular one, there were, for each team, there was somewhat of a stipulation. But before I touch there, I do want to say, for if you want to have somewhat of a stipulation on the Survivor Series matchups this year, make it something simple. Like the men's team, if Raw wins, or if SmackDown wins, the men's team, their brand gets the number 30 spot in the Royal Rumble. Not that whoever pins gets it or a member of the team, just that brand. So it's more, if you're going to make it brand versus brand, you can give the brand the number 30 spot in the Royal Rumble. And then leading up to that, you can touch back to it saying, well, we won this at Survivor Series, so you can have all these qualifying matches. It'll make the qualifying matches mean more because you know that number 30 spot is up for grabs. But anyway, back to this. There were stipulations in this one specifically. You'll hear all about it, but for Stone Cold Steve Austin's side, if his team didn't win, then Stone Cold was fired and he had to leave WWE. And if Eric Bischoff's team won, then each member of that team would get their own week as general manager of Raw. So basically, they get to call the shots. And Eric Bischoff's team did end up winning, but I am going to play the audio of the end of that match just to kind of give you an idea about exactly what Shawn Michaels was up to that night.
Stunner on Orton!
Well, you guys heard that. I mean, hearing it really doesn't do it quite the service that watching it does. But that entire, I mean, it's a 45-minute match. So Shawn Michaels has an absolute just show-stopping performance. That's where he basically gets his nickname from. I learned that night. And like they said, it was a 3-versus-1 advantage. Michael fought. He ended up having to get cheap-shotted by somebody who wasn't even in the match to lose, but it didn't really matter. It definitely pissed me off. I mean, I remember this. Just, of course, obviously, like I said, I didn't see it live, but I knew the stipulations. I knew what happened, and whenever I found out that Stone Cold Steve Austin was gone, I mean, I was legitimately furious as a 9-10-year-old kid, so. But after the match happens, after Stone Cold kind of realizes what's going on, He comes back out to the ring, and he gives a pretty heartfelt, what I feel like is very real, promo.
What's he gonna say? Good question. I started my career in 1989, right here in Dallas, Texas. And I wasn't looking for it to end the night, and I ain't happy about a damn thing, but if it's gonna end, at least the one thing I feel, and I don't feel good about a goddamn thing, but I feel justified that it started in Dallas, Texas. And it's been a hell of a damn ride. And I appreciate every single thing that you people have done for me. So I am feeling at least somewhat justified that it ended in Dallas, Texas. Been a lot of ups and downs, and it's been a hell of a ride, and there's been some good times, and there's damn sure been some bad times, and you ain't gonna hear Stone Cold Steve Austin say this a whole lot, but I'll go on the record of saying I love the shit out of you guys.
Well, there you go, you heard it from him himself. I mean, I got chills right now just listening to that. I've seen it before since then. It's something that kind of goes under the radar because Stone Cold Steve Austin isn't really a guy who opens up like that or tells you how he feels. And I know that Stone Cold is probably the most popular wrestler of all time. So you guys probably get close to like the same feeling that I get whenever you hear that glass break and he comes out, especially whenever the fans are there and you hear that pop. It's just nice to know that. I mean, it's kind of mutual. Like he loves the fans too, and we do mean a lot to him. So I don't know, that's just something that I wanted to make sure that all the listeners of this show got to hear, because I know that there are a lot of Stone Cold fans out there, and if you didn't get a chance to see that, I highly recommend you go back and watch that entire pay-per-view. You will definitely be glad that you did. But I hope that you like the audio I provided for you guys. I hope you like the top five and the SmackDown review itself. This has obviously been a little bit longer than I usually go, but I was excited to get to talk about all this stuff with you guys. I look forward to doing this every week. It's definitely something that I enjoy doing. I'm thankful that Matt gives me this opportunity to talk with you guys, and I am looking forward to continuing reviewing SmackDown for you. Like I said, if you have any suggestions for the top fives going forward, shoot them my way at Michael5Ritter on Twitter. I will definitely try to get those in the list. I have some ideas coming up. Like last week I did the Survivor Series teams. I kind of want to try to keep it at least somewhat themed into the time of year that we are in. But I do want to kind of hit you with these random ones like the character changes just to kind of, you know, keep you on your toes. You never know what you're going to get here. But anyway, guys, thanks so much for listening, and I will talk to you next week.